Book 3. If you are the Son of God, take yourself off this cross. Chapter 12. Outside Jerusalem, Sunday, April 2nd, A.D. 30, afternoon. The dusty dirt road from Galilee is once again clogged with Passover pilgrims, eager to enter the walls of Jerusalem and put their journey behind them. The day is sunny, as it is so often this time of year. The travelers push past date palm plantations and the former winter palaces of Herod the Great in the lush oasis of Jericho. Small farming villages soon follow, where fruit orchards, vineyards, and olive trees grow alongside irrigated fields of vegetables. Many of the travelers stop here for their ritual mikvah, purifying themselves for the final 3 miles of the journey. The purification process is vital to properly celebrating Passover. It creates a physical and emotional state of mind that prepares a worshiper to embrace God's holiness, thus the need to arrive in Jerusalem almost a week before the holy day. Men will immerse in the mikvah, then cease having sex with their wives until after Passover, believing the act of ejaculation makes the body impure. Likewise, menstruating women will be unable to immerse in the mikvah and will also be forbidden from entering the temple grounds. Touching a reptile also makes the body impure, and anyone coming into contact with a dead body or even having their shadow touch a dead body is immediately rendered impure and unable to celebrate Passover. This, of course, also applies to anyone who kills a person. So even before the pilgrims see Jerusalem, they are mentally preparing for the week to come. They think of the need for a mikvah, and they refrain from any intimate contact that might stir physical longings. Anticipating the smell of roast lamb that will hang over Jerusalem as the Passover feasts are being cooked in ovens, the pilgrims count their money, worrying about how they will pay for that feast and the inevitable taxes they will incur in the city. Despite their sore feet and aching legs from walking mile after rugged mile through the wilderness, the travelers feel themselves transformed by the magnetic pull of Jerusalem. Their thoughts are no longer set on the farms back home and the barley crop that must be harvested immediately upon their return, but on holiness and purity. Soon they will ascend the hill known as the Mount of Olives and look down upon the heart-stopping sight of Jerusalem in all its glory. The temple will gleam white and gold, and the mighty walls of the Temple Mount will astound them as always. The sheer magnificence of the temple will remind them that they have arrived at the center of Jewish life. It has been nearly 50 years since the temple was refurbished and expanded and the first modern Passover celebrated within its courts. But even for those old enough to have been there that first day, this Passover promises to be the most memorable in history. And today's arrival in Jerusalem will be unlike any before or to come. "We are going up to Jerusalem," Jesus tells his disciples as they prepare to depart for the Passover. "The Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will turn him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified. On the third day, he will be raised to life." But if those words disturb the disciples, they don't show it. For theirs has been a journey of many months rather than the mere days of most pilgrims. After the Feast of the Tabernacles 6 months ago, Jesus and the disciples did not return to Galilee. Instead, they began a roundabout trip. First stop, the village of Ephraim, only 15 miles north of Jerusalem. From there, they traveled as a group due north and away from Jerusalem to the border of Samaria and Galilee. And then when it came time for Passover, they turned in the opposite direction and marched due south along the Jordan River, joining the long caravans of pilgrims en route to the holy city. The disciples now jockey for position during the walk to Jerusalem. James and John ask the Nazarene if they can be his principal assistants in the new regime, requesting that one of us sit on your right and the other on your left in your glory. Upon hearing this, the other 10 are furious. They have followed Jesus as a collective group for more than 2 years, giving up their jobs and wives and whatever semblance of normal life they might have had. All the disciples hope they will reap the glory that will come after the new Messiah overthrows the Romans. Peter is so sure that Jesus is going to use military might that he is making plans to purchase a sword. But Jesus has no plans to wage war and no plans to form a new government. Rather than upbraid James and John, he calmly deflects their request. He then calls the disciples together, imploring them to focus on serving others rather than fighting for position. "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many," he tells them. Once again, Jesus is predicting his own death. And yet the disciples are so focused on the glorious moment when Jesus will reveal that he is the Christ, they ignore the fact that he is telling them he will soon die. There will be no overthrow of the Romans. There will be no new government. But the disciples' willful ignorance is understandable. Jesus often speaks in parables, and the mania surrounding the Nazarene is now phenomenal. The adoration being bestowed upon Jesus makes any talk of death incomprehensible. The thick crowds of pilgrims treat Jesus like royalty, hanging on his every word and greeting him with enthusiastic awe. In the village of Jericho, two blind men call out to Jesus, referring to him as Lord, Son of David, a designation that could be applied only to the Christ. The disciples are encouraged when Jesus does nothing to rebuke the blind men. Jerusalem is just a 40-minute walk from the village of Bethany, where they stop for the night. They stay at the house of Lazarus and his sisters Mary and Martha, rather than risk traveling after sundown and on the start of the Sabbath. This will be their base throughout Passover week, and Jesus and the disciples plan to return here most nights for the promise of a hot meal and easy rest. The Sabbath is the holiest day of the week. The Jews call it Shabbat, but the Romans name it for the planet Saturn. It is a day of mandatory rest in the Jewish religion, commemorating God's rest after creating the universe. Jesus and the apostles spend that time quietly preparing for the week to come. The next morning, Jesus selects two disciples and gives them a most special task. "Go to the village ahead of you," he orders them, "and at once you will find a donkey tied there, with her colt by her. Untie them and bring them to me. If anyone asks what you are doing, tell them that the Lord needs them, and he will send them right away." Then Jesus and the other 10 disciples set out, knowing that they will return to Lazarus's home that evening. They travel light, with no need for a satchel of supplies or the walking sticks most pilgrims carry. Crowds of pilgrims press in around Jesus as he walks. Their voices carry the familiar drawl of their regions. The pilgrims are excited that their journey is almost over, and many are rejoicing that the famous Jesus of Nazareth is now in their presence. Just on the other side of Bethpage, the two disciples stand waiting. One holds the bridle of a donkey that has never been ridden. The animal is bareback. A disciple removes his square cloak and lays it across the animal's back as an improvised saddle. The other disciples remove their cloaks and lay them on the ground in an act of submission, forming a carpet on which the donkey can walk. Following this example, many of the pilgrims remove their own cloaks and lay them on the ground. Others gather palm fronds or snap branches off olive and cypress trees and wave them with delight. This is the sign everyone has been waiting for. This is the fulfillment of Zechariah's prophecy. "Blessed is the King," shouts the disciple. The people join in, exalting Jesus and crying out to him. "Hosanna," they chant, "Hosanna in the highest." Jesus rides forth on the donkey, and the people bow down. "O Lord, save us," they implore, thankful that the Christ has finally come to rescue them. "O Lord, grant us success. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." The words of thanksgiving are from Psalm 118, a psalm sung at Passover. This is the moment for which these simple peasants have waited so long. Of all the thousands of pilgrims who set out from Galilee, these are the lucky few who can tell their children and their children's children that they witnessed the grand moment when Jesus the Christ rode triumphantly into Jerusalem. But not everybody bows down. A group of Pharisees has been waiting for Jesus and now look upon him with disgust. They call out to him, giving the Nazarene one last chance to avoid a charge of blasphemy. "Teacher," they yell, "rebuke your disciples." But Jesus refuses. "I tell you," he informs the Pharisees, "if they keep quiet, even the stones will cry out." Others who have heard that Jesus is near have run out from Jerusalem, spreading palm branches across the path of the Nazarene. This is a traditional sign of triumph and glory. The donkey stops atop the Mount of Olives. Jesus takes it all in. Tents cover the hillside, for this is where the poor Galileans camp during Passover. Jerusalem calls out to Jesus from just across the small Kidron Valley, and the temple gleams in the midday sun. Throngs of pilgrims line the path, winding down into the valley. The mud and limestone trail is remarkably steep, and Jesus will have to use great caution to guide the donkey downhill without getting thrown. This is his day. Jesus' whole life is pointed to this moment when he will ride forth to stake his claim to the title King of the Jews. Suddenly, Jesus begins to weep. Perhaps it's the thought of spending a last week with his good friends Lazarus, Mary, and Martha. Maybe he foresees the eventual destruction of this great city. Perhaps he looks upon Jerusalem knowing that his own pageantry will be short-lived, for the Nazarene has powerful enemies within the city walls. For the past 3 years, Jesus has been adored, but he has also been subject to attack and suspicion. Even his disciples, despite their deep belief in Jesus and his teachings, sometimes care more about jockeying for power than about understanding his true nature and his message for the world. He has been very specific with the disciples that he is more than just an earthly Christ, but they don't understand. He has told them again and again that he is a divine being, the Son of God. They cannot comprehend that concept. Jesus has made it clear that he is the Christ, but that his kingdom is not of this world. They don't understand what he's talking about. 3 times Jesus has told his disciples that he will die this week, but his followers refuse to even contemplate that. Most frustrating of all is the fear that his disciples cannot understand the true message of Jesus. These men know him better than any other. They've walked countless miles at his side, listened to his teachings for hours on end, and sat with him in quiet reverence to pray. Yet the disciples still do not understand who he truly claims to be. In his moment of triumph, Jesus is experiencing agony. He has long strategized about the words he will say at Passover and the effect they will have on his followers, both old and new. He knows that his claims of being a king will lead to his crucifixion. He will be sacrificed just as surely as those countless Passover lambs. It is just a matter of when. The Nazarene stares down at the path coursing through the olive trees. In the distance, he sees the garden at Gethsemane, and then the flat depression of the narrow Kidron Valley. Looking across the valley, he sees the same well-trod path rising up to Jerusalem's city walls. The city gates are clearly visible, as are the Roman soldiers who man the entrances. Jesus sees the people rushing out to worship him, eagerly ripping palm branches off nearby trees and waving them. The green flutter of respect impresses Jesus, for it is a reminder that many believe he is the Anointed One. Moses and David in the flesh come to save them and lead them out of bondage. But Jesus knows that while Moses and David are remembered for their great achievements, they were also cast out by society. Jesus is not a prince like Moses or a warrior like David. He is an intellectual. He deals in logic. The book of Deuteronomy predicted, "The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your fellow Israelites. You must listen to him." But that prophecy is dangerous. To claim he is the Son of God would make Jesus one of 3 things, a lunatic, a liar, or a divinity who fulfills Scripture. Few in the crowd believe Jesus is deranged or a charlatan, but will they make that incredible leap to believe that Jesus is God in the flesh? Time to go. As the hosannas rain down from all sides, and the Pharisees look on from a place nearby with their usual veiled contempt, Jesus coaxes the donkey forward. Step by careful step, the two descend the Mount of Olives, cross the Kidron Valley, and travel through a tunnel of worshipers, with Jesus riding majestically up the hill and into the great and golden city of Jerusalem. Chapter 13, Jerusalem, Monday, April 3rd, A.D. 30, morning. It is dawn. Jesus and the disciples are already on the move, walking purposefully from Bethany back into Jerusalem. The pandemonium of yesterday's jubilant entry into that city still rings in the Nazarene's ear. He was adored by the people as Jesus, the prophet from Nazareth in Galilee, when he dismounted at the city gates. It was a coronation of sorts, a celebration. But to the authorities, the exhibition is cause for great concern. Jerusalem hasn't seen such a moment since Jewish rebels tried to capture the city in 4 B.C. and again in A.D. 6. Those rebels, of course, paid for the action with their lives. Jesus knows this, just as he knows that the Roman governor and the Jewish high priest are constantly on the lookout for rebels and subversives. He is well aware that Pilate and Caiaphas received at least some word that the Nazarene had ridden into the city on a donkey, stirring up the Passover crowds. During the event, Jesus was calm, stepping down off the animal and walking straight up the great steps into the temple courts. He did not go there to teach, but to be a pilgrim, just like any man from Galilee, observing the sights and smells and sounds of the temple during Passover week. Roman soldiers are posted throughout the court of the Gentiles, and the temple guards no doubt took note of Jesus and the people who crowded around him. But none of them made a move to arrest the Nazarene. Apprehending such a beloved public figure might cause a riot. With Jews pouring into Jerusalem by the hundreds of thousands, even the smallest confrontation could quickly get out of hand. The soldiers and guards are armed, but their numbers are minuscule in comparison with the number of pilgrims. Anyone trying to take Jesus into custody could be overwhelmed by the peasant hordes. Anger about the injustice of arresting such a peaceful man as Jesus would blend with the people's simmering rage over heavy taxation. It was late afternoon when Jesus departed the temple courts in order to get back to Bethany before nightfall. He and the disciples retraced their steps back out of Jerusalem, past the tent camps on the Mount of Olives, where trampled palm leaves and olive branches still littered the dirt road. Even though the crowds made it clear that they wanted him to be their king and treated his arrival as a prelude to his coronation, Jesus neither said nor did anything to lead Caiaphas or Pilate to believe he was plotting a rebellion. But this day, a Monday, will be very different. Jesus spots a fig tree. He and the 12 are just outside Bethany, and Jesus has had little to eat this morning. He walks alone to the tree, hoping to pluck a piece of fruit, even though he knows that figs are out of season. Jesus scours the twisted branches but sees only leaves. He's annoyed at the tree. "May no one ever eat fruit from you again," he says. The outburst is uncharacteristic, and the disciples take note. But Jesus is just getting started. Once again, the group walks into Jerusalem and straight to the temple. It has been 3 years since Jesus turned over the money changers' tables. But now, he plans to do it again. Only this time, he has no whip and is no longer an unknown figure. The first incident was not quite forgotten, but it was minor enough that Jesus was able to resume his teaching in the courts almost immediately. Things are very different now. The stakes are higher. Jesus of Nazareth is famous. People follow him wherever he goes. His every movement is watched as the Pharisees wait for him to make the vital slip-up that will allow them to turn public opinion against him. The smart move would be for Jesus to avoid controversy, to remain peaceful, to let the status quo hum along as smoothly as during every other Passover. A jarring public display of temper would be most unwise. But Jesus doesn't care. Without warning, he flips over a table and sends coins flying, then another and another. There are no vendors selling sheep and cattle today, so Jesus makes his statement by releasing the caged sacrificial doves and overturning the benches of the men who sell them. He then confronts those standing in line before the tables, driving away anyone in the act of buying or selling. He is angry, but not out of control. His actions are methodical, and his every movement shows that he fears no soldier or guard. When the confrontation is done, Jesus stands in the middle of the carnage. Coins litter the ground. Doves circle and land. "Hosanna," comes the cry of a spectator. "It is written," Jesus calls out to the crowd, now ringing around him. The onlookers include irate money changers and the sellers of doves. Also present are parents with their children in tow, just like Mary and Joseph were with the young Jesus so many years ago. A substantial number of people in the crowd are followers of the Nazarene. "My house will be called a house of prayer," Jesus says, quoting Isaiah, the prophet who foresaw so much of the Nazarene's life. "But you are making it into a den of robbers." The robbers quote comes from Jeremiah, the prophet who was threatened with death for daring to predict the fall of the temple. The temple guards are tense. They knew that arresting Jesus is now completely justifiable. He has interfered with the flow of commerce and called the temple his home, as if he were God. But a quick scan of the crowd shows this would be unwise. The people aren't afraid of Jesus. They're empowered by him. He's just on something they've wanted to do every time they stood in that long line to change their money, watching corrupt men siphon off a significant piece of their earnings. Even the little children are cheering for Jesus. "Hosanna to the Son of David," a child calls out. And then, as if it were a game, another child calls out the same thing. Soon, some in the crowd beg to be healed right there in the temple. The Pharisees, as always, are watching. Do you hear what these children are saying? The chief priests and scribes call out indignantly to Jesus. The chief priests have now joined the crowd and observe Jesus with great concern. They will report his every move back to Caiaphas and perhaps even to Annas, the powerful former high priest, who is also Caiaphas's father-in-law. The aging Annas is just as wily as Caiaphas and still wields a great deal of influence. More hosannas ring throughout the temple court, shouted again and again by children. Do you hear what these people are saying? The chief priests repeat. From the lips of children and infants you have ordained praise, Jesus tells them, quoting from David. The religious leaders know the psalm well. It is a call for God to bask in the adoration of the children, than to rise up and strike hard at the powers of darkness that stand against him. If the Pharisees' interpretation is correct, Jesus is actually comparing them with forces of evil. Still, they don't motion for Jesus to be arrested, nor do they try to stop him as he leaves the temple, trailed by his disciples. The sun is now setting, and the first cooking fires are being lit on the Mount of Olives. Jesus and the disciples once again make the long walk back to Bethany. For now, he is a free man. For now. 600 years ago, when Jeremiah prophesied that the temple would be destroyed, he was punished by being lowered into an empty well. He sank up to his waist in mud and was left to die. 32 years from now, a peasant named Jesus ben Ananias will also predict the temple's destruction. He will be declared a madman at first, but his life will be spared by order of the Roman governor, but only after he is flogged until his bones show. But the time of Jesus is different. He is not a lone man, but a revolutionary with a band of disciples and a growing legion of followers. His outbursts in the temple are an aggressive act against the religious leaders rather than a passive prediction that the temple will one day fall. Jesus is now openly antagonistic toward temple authorities. Caiaphas has seen what happens when political revolt breaks out in the temple courts and remembers the burning of the temple porticos after the death of Herod. He believes Jesus to be a false prophet. Today's display truly shows how dangerous Jesus has become. The threat must be squelched. As the temple's high priest and most powerful Jewish authority in the world, Caiaphas is bound by religious law to take extreme measures against Jesus immediately. If a prophet or one who foretells by dreams appears among you and announces to you a sign of wonder, the book of Deuteronomy reads, that prophet or dreamer must be put to death for inciting rebellion against the Lord your God. Caiaphas knows that Jesus is playing a very clever game by using the crowds as a tool to prevent his arrest. This is a game that Caiaphas plans to win. But to avoid the risk of becoming impure, he must move before sundown on Friday and the start of the Passover. This is the biggest week of the year for Caiaphas. He has an extraordinary number of obligations and administrative tasks to tend to if the Passover celebration is to come off smoothly. Rome is watching him closely, through the eyes of Pontius Pilate, and any failure on the part of Caiaphas during the most vital festival might lead to his dismissal. But nothing matters more than silencing Jesus. Time is running out. Passover begins in 4 short days. Chapter 14, Jerusalem, Tuesday, April 3rd, AD 30, morning. The serenity of Lazarus's home provides Jesus and the disciples instant relief. After the day in the temple and the 2-mile walk from Jerusalem back to Bethany, the men are spent. Hospitality is a vital aspect of Jewish society, dating back to the days when the patriarch Abraham treated all guests as if they were angels in disguise, offering them lavish meals of veal, butter, bread, and milk. So it is that the spacious home of Lazarus, with its large courtyard and thick door to keep out intruders, is not just a refuge for Jesus and his disciples, but also a vibrant link to the roots of their Jewish faith. The sisters of Lazarus, Martha and Mary, dote on Jesus, though in opposite ways. Martha is the older of the two and hypervigilant, constantly fussing over the Nazarene. Mary, meantime, is enthralled with Jesus. She sits at his feet and sometimes shows her respect by anointing them with perfumed oil. In their own way, each woman gives him comfort. They also see to it that Jesus and the disciples remove their sandals and wash their feet upon returning each evening, so that any impurities or infections might be cleansed. A stepped pool in the basement offers Jesus a place to remove his robe and sleeveless knee-length tunic, so that Martha and Mary can wash those too. He will then bathe and change into his other set of clothes. And of course, Jesus and the others will wash their hands before sitting down to eat. This week, Martha and Mary are serving two meals a day. Dinner consists of fresh bread, olive oil, soup, and sometimes beef or salted fish washed down with homemade wine. Breakfast features bread and fruit, though dried instead of fresh because melons and pomegranates are out of season. As Jesus learned on the road yesterday morning, fruit from the local fig and date orchards will not ripen for months to come. There is no record about how Lazarus earned money. But because Bethany is the breadbasket of Jerusalem, he most likely was a land-owning farmer. Lazarus has a reputation for being charitable and can afford to offer his guests gracious hospitality. It's customary to take in passing strangers who need a place to sleep overnight. This becomes an issue during Passover when entire families require shelter for a week. A man needs to be a shrewd judge of character in times like these, balancing hospitality with the possibility that he might unwittingly invite thieves or ne'er-do-wells into his home. Even though Lazarus truly enjoys being with Jesus, the Nazarene's presence means much more than that. This is a man whom Lazarus trusts, reveres, and indeed says he owes his very life to. The fact that Jesus travels with a dozen grown men, each with a man-sized appetite and requiring a place to sleep, is a small price to pay for the Nazarene's company. Besides, a fussy Martha can easily handle the needs of all the men. Footnote: the legend of Jesus' raising of Lazarus from the dead became so widespread that it was a main component in the temple priest's plotting against Jesus. Dawn breaks. The countdown of Passover continues as the citizens of Bethany stir. Some prepare for a day's work in the nearby fields, and others plan a walk into Jerusalem. Like people everywhere, they start the morning with their daily ablutions. There are no indoor toilets, so men and women alike venture outside to a concealed private spot, a hole in the ground into which a spade of dirt from a nearby pile of earth is promptly thrown, meets this need. Teeth are cleaned with a short, soft branch pulled straight off a tree and chewed. Inside Lazarus's home, Jesus and his disciples wash their hands and eat their daily bread before setting out for another day in the temple courts. The group falls in alongside a line of travelers. Today will be the last time Jesus ever teaches in the temple courts, and he has prepared a number of parables that will explain difficult theological issues in ways that even the most unread listener can understand. "Rabbi, look," explains a disciple, as they walk past the fig tree Jesus confronted yesterday. "Its roots are now shriveled." "How did the fig tree wither so quickly?" the disciple asks. "Truly I tell you, if you have faith and do not doubt, not only can you do what was done to the fig tree, but you can also say to this mountain, 'Go, throw yourself into the sea,' and it will be done. If you believe, you will receive whatever you ask for in prayer," Jesus responds. For years to come, the disciples will marvel at what happened to that simple tree. They will write about it with awe, even decades from now, and quote Jesus' two-sentence response. Even though Jesus has performed wonders in front of them, this one seems to amaze them almost more than any other. But the fig tree is just a start. The disciples will remember the events that take place today for as long as they live. They will quote Jesus again and again, not in sentences, but in paragraphs and pages. The next 12 hours will be so exhausting that Jesus will make tomorrow a day of complete rest. But it will also become a time of challenge and triumph unlike any other they have ever known. This morning is beautiful. The sun shines. The cool April air is verdant with the fresh smells of young spring growth from the fields and orchards lining the road. New life is everywhere, even as death approaches. As the group draws close to Jerusalem, Jesus knows that a drama will unfold. He sensed it yesterday as the religious leaders hovered at the fringe of every crowd, watching him intently as he interacted with his followers. This week, these priests and Pharisees are wearing robes that are even more resplendent than normal, choosing their most colorful and expensive garments as a way of setting themselves apart from the drably dressed pilgrims. The priestly robes are a reminder that the priests are vital members of the temple, not mere visitors. Jesus, meantime, still clothes himself like an average Galilean. He wears a seamless tunic and over it a simple robe. Sandals protect his feet from sharp pebbles and sticks as he walks, but do little to keep off the dust. So the walk from Bethany down into Jerusalem often gives him an unwashed appearance by comparison to that of the Pharisees, many of whom have bathing facilities and ritual pools in their nearby homes. And while his accent might sound provincial within the confines of cosmopolitan Jerusalem, Jesus does nothing to hide his native tongue. If anything, it works to his advantage, for it so often leads the religious leaders to underestimate the Nazarene as just another pilgrim from Galilee. Jesus and the disciples pass through the city gates. Their movements are now being closely tracked by the religious authorities, so their arrival is noted immediately. Jerusalem has grown louder and more festive with every passing day, as pilgrims continue to travel there from throughout the world. Voices in Greek, Aramaic, Latin, Egyptian, and Hebrew fill the air. The bleating of lambs is another constant, as shepherds bring tens of thousands of the small animals into the city to have their throats slit on Friday. That grisly duty will be performed by high priests, who stand for hours in the hot sun as the blood of the lamb soaks into their white ceremonial robes. Jesus enters the temple courts. Today he ignores the money changers and the men selling doves. He selects a spot in the shaded awnings of Solomon's porch and begins to teach. The religious leaders arrive almost immediately, interrupting him. "By what authority are you doing these things?" the chief priest demands, referring to reported acts of healing that Jesus performed yesterday. The interrogators who stand before the Nazarene are not just common Pharisees or scribes, but the most elite of the religious leaders. Their presence is meant to awe those pilgrims who might otherwise be transfixed by Jesus. Their goal is to use their intellectual prowess to make the Nazarene appear stupid. "And who gave you this authority?" asks the second priest. "I will ask you one question," Jesus replies calmly. "If you answer, I will tell you by what authority I am doing these things." He has thought deeply and anticipated their questions. The religious leaders have spoken with the Pharisees who traveled to Galilee last year and are well aware that Jesus is clever. But they think him to be uneducated and unread and hope to lure him into a theological trap. The priests await Jesus' question. "John's baptism," Jesus asks, "where did it come from? Was it from heaven or from men?" The religious leaders do not answer immediately. The crowd looks on apprehensively. On one side stands Jesus, on the other side, the self-proclaimed holy man. Finally, the chief priests talk among themselves, debating Jesus' question from all angles. "If we say from heaven," you will ask, "then why did we not believe him?" Jesus says nothing. The leaders continue with their private conversation. "But if we say that John's baptism came from men, we are afraid of the people, for they all hold that John was a prophet." Jesus still remains silent. The men haven't given him an answer, and the crowd knows it. It is becoming clear that the chief priests and elders are no different than those Pharisees who tried but failed to trap Jesus in Galilee. Once again, the leaders are on the defensive. Their trap for Jesus has failed. "We don't know," a chief priest finally says. "I'll tell you the truth," Jesus replies in full view of his audience. "Tax collectors and prostitutes are entering the kingdom of God ahead of you. For John came to you to show the way of righteousness, and you did not believe him. But the tax collectors and prostitutes did, and even after you saw this, you did not repent and believe him." The crowd is awed. The high priests are stunned into silence. Word of Jesus' intellectual victory spreads through the temple courts. The pilgrims now love Jesus even more. They are speaking of him as a true prophet and hope he will live up to the promise of his celebratory entry into Jerusalem just 2 short days ago. The sun climbs higher and higher into the sky, and business in the temple courts goes on as Jesus holds the crowd in thrall. Rather than back down after their early embarrassment, the chief priests and elders continue to look on. The Nazarene tells a parable about a wealthy landowner and his troublesome tenants. The summation is a line stating that the religious leaders will lose their authority and be replaced by others whose belief is more genuine. Then Jesus tells a second parable about heaven, comparing it to a wedding, with God as the father of the groom, preparing a luxurious banquet for his son's guests. Again, the religious leaders are the subject of the final line, a barb about a guest who shows up poorly dressed and is then bound hand and foot and thrown from the ceremony. "For many are invited," Jesus says of heaven, "but few are chosen." This stings badly. The authority of the religious leaders is that they are the chosen ones. For Jesus to say publicly that they are not is an enormous defamation of their character. So they finally leave the temple courts and switch tactics, sending their own disciples out to wage theological battle. These disciples are smart. Rather than attacking Jesus, they try to soften him up with flattery. "Teacher, we know you are a man of integrity, and that you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. You aren't swayed by men because you pay no attention to who they are." Then the flattery ends. Aware that they're unlikely to catch Jesus in a theological misstatement, the Pharisees' disciples now try to frame Jesus by using Rome. "What is your opinion?" they ask. "Is it right to pay taxes to Caesar or not?" "Why are you trying to trap me?" Jesus sees. He asks for someone to hand him a denarius. "Whose portrait is this?" he asks, holding up the coin. "And whose inscription?" "Caesar's," they answer. "Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's," Jesus tells them, "and to God what is God's." Again, the crowd is awed. Although Caesar is a feared name, the Nazarene has marginalized Rome without directly offending it. The brilliance of Jesus' words will last throughout the ages. Having failed in their mission, the disciples now leave. They are soon replaced by the Sadducees, a wealthy and more liberal temple sect, who count Caiaphas among their number. Once again, they try to pierce the aura of Jesus' vulnerability with a religious riddle, and once again they fail. Soon the Pharisees step forward to take their turn. "Teacher," asks their leader, a man known for being an expert in the law, "what is the greatest commandment in the law?" Under the teaching of the Pharisees, there are 613 religious statutes. Even though each carries a designation marking it as either great or little, the fact remains that each must be followed. Asking Jesus to select just one is a clever way of pushing him into a corner, making him defend his choice. But Jesus does not choose from one of the established laws. Instead, he articulates a new one. "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment." The Pharisees stand silent. How could anyone argue with that? Only Jesus goes on to add a second law. "Love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments." Jesus has now defeated the sharpest minds in the temple. But he does not settle for victory and walk away. Instead, the Nazarene turns and excoriates the priests in front of the pilgrims. "Everything they do is for men to see," he tells the crowd. "They make their phylacteries wide and the tassels on their garments long. They love the place of honor at banquets and the most important seats in the synagogues. They love to be greeted in the marketplace and to have men call them rabbi." 6 times Jesus denounces the Pharisees as hypocrites. He calls them a brood of vipers. He tells them they are unclean. He denounces them for focusing on such trivial details of religious life as whether to tithe their allotment of herbs and spices, in a process completely missing the true heart of God's law. Worst of all, Jesus predicts that these holy men will be condemned to hell. "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem," Jesus laments, knowing his time of teaching is done. The Nazarene departs the temple and will not be seen in public until the time of his condemnation. In fact, he seals his death sentence by predicting the destruction of the temple. "Do you see all these great stones?" he asks. "Not one stone will be left on another. Every one will be thrown down." Jesus says these words to his disciples, but a Pharisee overhears. That statement will become a capital crime. A short time later, Jesus sits atop the Mount of Olives, a week that begun in this very spot with him weeping while astride a donkey now finds him reflective. With the disciples sitting at his side, Jesus summarizes his short life. Darkness is falling as he tells his followers to live their lives to the fullest, speaking in parables so they will comprehend the magnitude of his words. The disciples listen in rapt fascination, but grow concerned as Jesus predicts that after his death they too will be persecuted and killed. Perhaps to lessen the impact of this, Jesus shares his thoughts on heaven and promises the disciples that God will reveal himself to them and the world. "As you know," Jesus concludes, "the Passover is 2 days away, and the Son of Man will be handed over to be crucified." Even as Jesus speaks, the chief priests and the elders gather at Caiaphas' palace. They are now in a frenzy. Killing the Nazarene is the only answer. but time is short. First, Jesus must be arrested. After his arrest, there must be a trial. But the religious laws state that no trials can be held during Passover, and none can be held at night. If they are to kill Jesus, he must be arrested either tomorrow or Thursday and tried before sundown. Making matters even more pressing is that the religious stipulation that if a death penalty is ordered, a full night must pass before the sentence can be carried out. All of these details, Caiaphas knows, can be massaged. The most important thing right now is to take Jesus into custody. The other problems can be addressed once that occurs. None of the people who have listened to Jesus in the temple courts can be alerted, or there could be a riot. Such a confrontation would mean Pontius Pilate's getting involved and Caiaphas being blamed. So the arrest must be an act of stealth. For that, Caiaphas will need some help. Little does he know that one of Jesus' own disciples is making plans to provide it. All he wants in return is money. Chapter 15, Jerusalem, Wednesday, April 4th, AD 30, night. Judas Iscariot travels alone. Jesus has chosen to spend this day to rest, and now he and the other disciples remain behind at the home of Lazarus as Judas walks into Jerusalem by himself. It's been 5 days since the disciples arrived in Bethany and 3 since Jesus rode into Jerusalem on the donkey. But Jesus has yet to announce publicly that he is the Christ, nor has he done anything to lead an uprising against Rome. But he has enraged the religious leaders, which has put targets on his back and those of the disciples. You will be handed over to be persecuted and put to death, and you will be hated by all the nations because of me, Jesus predicted yesterday when they were all sitting atop the Mount of Olives. Judas did not sign on to be hated or executed. If Jesus just admits he's the Christ, then he would triumph over the Romans. Surely the religious authorities would then be eager to align themselves with Jesus. All this talk of death and execution might come to an end. So Judas has decided to force Jesus' hand. Judas made his decision moments ago during dinner, when Jesus and the disciples were eating at the home of a man named Simon the leper. The group lounged on pillows around the banquet table, plucking food from the small plates in the center with their right hand. As had happened so many times before, a woman approached Jesus to anoint him with perfume. It was Mary, sister of Lazarus, who broke off the thick neck of a flask and poured nard, an exotic scent imported from India, on Jesus' head in a show of devotion. Judas expressed revulsion at such a waste of money. Passover, in particular, is a time when it's customary to give money to the poor. This time he was not alone in his disgust. Several other disciples joined in before Jesus put an end to the discussion. Leave her alone, Jesus ordered the disciples. Why are you bothering her? She has done a beautiful thing to me. The poor you will always have with you, and you can help them any time you want. But you will not always have me. She did what she could. She poured perfume on my body beforehand to prepare for my burial. Once again, Jesus' words were bewildering. He allowed himself to be anointed like the Christ, and yet he was predicting his death. Now, Judas boldly walks back into Jerusalem. The night air smells of wood smoke from the many campfires. Passover starts on the night of the first full moon after the spring equinox, which will be Friday evening. Judas picks his way carefully down the bumpy dirt road. His march could be an act of stupidity. He knows this, for he is intent on going directly to the palace of Caiaphas, the most powerful man in the Jewish world. Judas believes that he has an offer of great value that will interest the leader of the Sanhedrin. Judas is a known disciple of Jesus, however, and this strategy could very well lead him to be arrested. Even if nothing like that happens, Judas is uncertain if an exalted religious leader such as Caiaphas will meet with an unwashed follower of Jesus. Making his way from the valley and through Jerusalem's gates, Judas navigates the crowded streets to the expensive neighborhoods of the upper city. He finds the home of Caiaphas and tells the guards his business. Much to his relief, Judas is not arrested. Instead, he's warmly welcomed into the spacious palace and led to a lavish room where the high priest is meeting with the other priests and elders. The conversation immediately turns to Jesus. What are you willing to give me if I hand him over? Judas asks. If the high priests are surprised by Judas's behavior, they don't show it. They have set aside their normal arrogance. Their goal is to manipulate Judas into doing whatever it takes to arrange Jesus' arrest. 30 silver coins, comes the reply. This is 120 denarii, the equivalent of 4 months' wages. Judas has lived the hand-to-mouth existence of Jesus' disciples for 2 long years, rarely having more than a few extra coins in his purse, and very little in the way of luxury. Now the chief priest is offering him a lucrative bounty to select a time and place, far from the temple courts, to arrest Jesus. Judas is a schemer. He has plotted the odds so that they are in his favor. He knows that if he takes the money, one of two things will happen. Jesus will be arrested and then declare himself to be the Christ. If the Nazarene truly is the Messiah, then he will have no problem saving himself from Caiaphas and the high priests. However, if Jesus is not the Christ, he will die. Either way, Judas's life will be spared. Judas and Caiaphas make the deal. The traitor's disciple promises to begin searching immediately for a place to hand Jesus over. This will mean working closely with the temple guards to arrange the arrest. He will have to slip away from Jesus and the other disciples to alert his new allies of Jesus' whereabouts. That may be difficult. 30 silver coins are counted out before Judas' eyes. They clang off one another as they fall into his purse. The traitor is paid in advance. Judas walks alone back to Bethany. Robbers may be lurking on the roads. Judas wonders how he will explain his absence to Jesus and the others, and where he will hide such a large and noisy bounty. But it will all work out, for Judas truly believes that he is smarter than his compatriots and deserving of reward in this life. If Jesus is God, that will soon be known. The next few hours will tell the tale. Chapter 16, Lower City of Jerusalem, Thursday, April 4th, AD 30, night. Jesus has so much to do in a very short period of time. He must at last define his life to the disciples. As the final hours of Passover approach, Jesus plans to organize a last meal with his followers before saying goodbye, for they have been eyewitnesses to his legacy, and he must trust them to pass it on. But although these things are vitally important, there is something holding him back: the terrifying prospect of his coming death. So Jesus is having trouble focusing on his final message to the disciples. Like every Jew, the Nazarene knows the painful horror and humiliation that await those condemned to the cross. He firmly believes he must fulfill what has been written in Scripture, but panic is overtaking him. It doesn't help that the entire city of Jerusalem is in an anxious frenzy of last-minute Passover preparation. Everything must be made perfect for the holiday. A lamb must be purchased for the feast, and not just any lamb, but an unblemished 1-year-old male. And each home must be cleansed of leavened bread. Everywhere throughout Jerusalem, women frantically sweep floors and wipe down counters because even so much as a single crumb can bring forth impurity. At the home of Lazarus, Mary and Martha are fastidious in their scrubbing and sweeping. After sundown, Lazarus will walk through the house with a candle in a symbolic search for any traces of leavened products. Finding none, it is hoped he will declare his household ready for Passover. At the palace home of the high priest Caiaphas, slaves and servants comb the grounds of the enormous estate in search of any barley, wheat, rye, oats, or spelt. They scrub sinks, ovens, and stoves of any trace of leaven. They sterilize pots and pans inside and out by bringing water to a boil in them, then adding a brick to allow the scalding water to flow over the sides. Silverware is being heated to a glow, then placed one at a time into the boiling water. There is no need, however, to purchase a sacrificial lamb, as Caiaphas' family owns the entire temple lamb concession. At the former palace of Herod the Great, where Pontius Pilate and his wife Claudia once again are enduring Passover, there are no such preparations. The Roman governor begins his day with a shave, for he is clean-shaven and short-haired in the imperial fashion of the day. He cares little for Jewish tradition. He's not interested in the traditional belief that Moses and the Israelites were forced to flee Egypt without giving their bread time to rise, which led to the leavened products being forbidden on Passover. For him, there is breakfast, lunch, and dinner, including plenty of bread, most often leavened with salt instead of yeast, in the Roman tradition. Back at his palace in Caesarea, Pilate might also be able to enjoy oysters and a slice of roast pork with his evening meal. But no such delicacies exist or are permitted within observant Jerusalem, particularly not on the eve of Passover. In fact, Caiaphas and the high priest will even refrain from entering Herod's palace as the feast draws near. for fear of becoming impure in the presence of the Romans and their pagan ways. This is actually a blessing for Pilate, ensuring him a short holiday from dealing with the Jews and their never-ending problems. Or so he thinks. Judas Iscariot watches Jesus with a quiet intensity, waiting for the Nazarene to reveal his Passover plans so that he can then slip away and inform Caiaphas. It would be easy enough to ask the high priest to send temple guards to the home of Lazarus, but arresting Jesus so far from Jerusalem could be a disaster. Too many pilgrims would see the Nazarene march back into the city in chains, thus possibly provoking the very riot scenario that so terrifies the religious leaders. Judas is sure that none of the other disciples knows he has betrayed Jesus, so he bides his time, listening and waiting for that moment when Jesus summons his followers and tells them it is time to walk back into Jerusalem. It seems incomprehensible that Jesus would not return to the Holy City at least one more time during their stay. Perhaps Jesus is waiting for Passover to begin, to reveal that he is the Christ. If so, then Scripture says this must happen in Jerusalem. Sooner or later, the Nazarene will go back to the Holy City. Next to the temple in the Antonia Fortress, the enormous citadel where Roman troops are garrisoned, hundreds of soldiers file into the dining hall for their evening meal. These barracks are connected to the temple at the northwest corner, and most men have stood guard today, walking through the military-only gate and onto the 45-foot platform atop the colonnades that line the temple walls. From there, it is easy enough to look down on the Jewish pilgrims as they fuss over last-minute Passover preparations. The entire week has been demanding and chaotic for the soldiers, who have spent hours standing in the hot sun. But tomorrow will be their most demanding day of all. Lambs and pilgrims will be everywhere, and the stench of drying blood and animal defecation will waft up to them from the innermost temple courts. The slaughter will go on for hours, as will the sight of men clutching the bloody carcasses of lambs to their chests as they rush from the temple courts to cook their evening seder. Normally, the garrison comprises little more than 500 soldiers and an equivalent number of support staff. But with Tiberius Caesar's troops having arrived from Caesarea for Passover, the number of legionaries is swollen into the thousands, and accompanying them is a full complement of support units and personal servants to shoe horses, tend to the baggage, and carry water. Thus, the dining hall is loud and boisterous as the men sit down to a first course of vegetables flavored with garum, the fermented sauce made of fish intestines that is a staple of Roman meals. The second course is porridge, made more flavorful with spices and herbs. Sometimes there is meat, but it's been hard to procure this week. Bread is the staple of the soldiers' diet, as is the sour wine, made by combining vinegar, sugar, table wine, and grape juice. Like everything else set before these famished men, these are consumed quickly and in large quantities. 12 soldiers hunch over their meals with the knowledge that they will witness the slaughter of much more than sheep tomorrow. For these are the men of the crucifixion death squads, soldiers of impressive strength and utter brutality assigned to the backbreaking task of hanging men on the cross, Roman style. Each crucifixion death squad consists of four men known as a quaternio. A fifth man, a centurion known as the exactor mortis, oversees their actions. Tomorrow, three teams of killers will be needed, for three men have been condemned to die. The initial floggings will take place within the Jerusalem city walls, but the hard work of hoisting the men up onto the cross will take place outside on a hill known as Calvaria, or as the Jews say in Aramaic, Golgotha, or as it will go down in history, Golgotha. Each word means the same thing, skull, the shape of the low rise that is the place of execution. Even as the quaternio gulp down their dinner, the vertical pole onto which each man will be nailed already rests in the ground. These staticula remain in position at all times awaiting the arrival of the patibulum, the crossbar that is carried by the condemned. In truth, a crucifixion can be accomplished with fewer than five men, but Roman standards are high, and it's part of each executioner's job to keep an eye on his fellow members, ensuring that there is no sign of lenience toward the prisoner. A smaller death squad might not be as diligent. So it is that these well-trained soldiers approach tomorrow's crucifixions with total commitment. Anything less might result in their own punishment. One of the men they will crucify is a common murderer named Barabbas. The other two are suspected of being his accomplices. In the morning, the death squads will begin the ritual crucifixion process. It is intensely physical work, and by day's end, their uniforms and bodies will be drenched in blood. But the soldiers of the death squads don't mind. In fact, many of them enjoy the work. They are thugs, tough men from Samaria and Caesarea, whose job it is to send a message. Rome is all-powerful. Violate its law, and you will die a grisly death. It is evening as Jesus leads the disciples back to Jerusalem for their final meal together. A benefactor has kindly rented a room for Jesus in the lower city. It is on the second floor of a building near the Pool of Siloam. A long rectangular table, just 18 inches tall, is the centerpiece of the room. It is surrounded by pillows on which Jesus and his disciples can lounge in the traditional fashion as they eat. The room is large enough for all to recline comfortably, but small enough so that their overlapping conversations will soon fill the room with high-volume festive sounds. Jesus sends John and Peter ahead to find the room and assemble the meal. This is most likely a tense time for Judas Iscariot, for he finally knows that Jesus plans to return to Jerusalem, but he doesn't know the hour or the exact location. And even when he obtains the information, he must still find a way to sneak off and alert Caiaphas. Once in the room, Jesus begins the evening by humbling himself and washing each man's feet with water. This is a task normally reserved for slaves and servants, and certainly not for a venerated teacher of the faith. The disciples are touched by the show of civility and the humility it implies. Jesus knows them and their personality so well, and accepts them without judgment. Simon the Zealot with his passion for politics, the impulsive Peter, James and John, the boisterous sons of thunder, as Jesus describes them, the intense and often gloomy Thomas, the upbeat Andrew, the downtrodden Philip, and the rest. Their time together has changed the lives of every man in the room. And as Jesus carefully and lovingly rinses the road dust from their feet, the depths of his affection is clear. During dinner, Jesus turns all that good feeling into despair. "I tell you the truth," he says, "one of you will betray me." The disciples haven't been paying close attention to their leader. The meal has been served and they are reclined, chatting with one another as they pick food from the small plates. But now shock and sadness fill the room. The disciples each take mental inventory, searching for some sign of doubt or weakness that would cause any of them to hand over Jesus. "Surely not I, Lord," they say one by one. The comment goes around the table. "It is one of the 12," Jesus assures them, "one who dips bread into the bowl with me. The Son of Man will go, just as it is written. But woe to the man that betrays the Son of Man. It would be better for him had he not been born." As the conversation roars back into life with each man wondering to his neighbor about the identity of the betrayer, Peter in particular is agitated. He signals to John, who rests on the pillow next to Jesus. "Ask him which one he means," Peter says. "Lord, who is it?" John asks, leaning closer to the Nazarene. He sits to Jesus' right, while Judas sits on Jesus' immediate left. "Surely not I, Rabbi," Judas blurts out. "Yes, it is you," Jesus quietly answers. "What you are about to do, do quickly." The room is noisy as the men talk among themselves, and most miss the final exchange between Judas and Jesus, because the two men are sitting so close together. As Judas hastily stands and leaves, some assume he's off to get more food or drink. The traitor steps out into the night. Both he and the Nazarene know exactly where he's going. Jesus once trusted Judas, appointing him treasurer of the disciples, and openly called him friend. But as so often happens when money is involved, years of friendship can quickly evaporate. Clutching his money bag, Judas walks through the streets and narrow alleys of the lower city and up the steep hill to give Caiaphas the good news. The hour is late, and Jesus is on the move. He and his disciples walk across the Kidron Valley to an olive garden at the base of the Mount of Olives. Even though he knows they must be weary from the wine and food, he asks the disciples to stand guard while he climbs the hillside to find a private place to be alone. "Sit here while I pray," he orders the men before ascending the steep slope. "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death," he tells the disciples. "Stay here and keep watch." The moon is nearly full and provides ample light. Jesus finds a place in the darkness and prays. "Father, everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will. It is a moment of anguish and despair. Jesus is convinced that he will die. It will be a bloody death on a Roman cross with all the pain and public ridicule that implies. The people who have heard his marvelous words in the temple courts will see him humiliated, and they will not understand how a man who claims to be the Son of God could allow himself to be crucified. It would be so much easier if Jesus could just escape. He could keep on climbing the hill and walk straight back to Bethany. In the morning, he might journey home to Galilee, there to grow old quietly and raise a family. His words have accomplished just enough to give the people hope, but he never planned to lead them in rebellion. Jesus does not believe that it is his earthly purpose, so he accepts his coming fate and makes no effort to flee. After about an hour of prayer, Jesus returns to the garden at Gethsemane, but the disciples are sound asleep. "Could you not keep watch for an hour?" the Nazarene demands to know. The disciples don't have an answer, but Jesus once again asks that they stay awake while he returns to his private spot for more prayer. In the solitude of the night, Jesus asks God for relief. He is a man for whom faith comes easily, and making this request should be simple, but it is not. So now he prays a different prayer, one that asks for the strength to endure all that is to come. "My Father, if it is not possible for this cup to be taken away, unless I drink it, may your will be done," Jesus pleads. The Nazarene walks back down the slope to check on the disciples. All again are asleep, seemingly untroubled by worry or anguish. They seem to have ignored every single word Jesus has spoken to them about his suffering and impending death. It is as if they are willing to believe parts of his teaching and to wonder at his accomplishments, but they cannot accept the dark side of his message. Jesus walks back up the hill to pray one last time. In his chronicling of the Nazarene's final days, the physician Luke put forth that Jesus began literally sweating blood. This condition is known as hematidrosis and is brought on by intense anxiety. Footnote: although none of the gospel writers was actually present during Jesus' prayer in the garden, it is believed that he shared his words and emotions with those present below him that night. Though rare, it is most often seen in condemned men as they begin walking toward their execution site. His prayer is finished. Jesus returns to his disciples exhausted. The hour is past midnight, the air growing colder. Jesus wears just his cloak and sheer tunic, which allow his lean body little defense against the elements. The panic he experienced has not subsided. Jesus knows the end could come at any moment. But now, as he once again enters the garden at Gethsemane, he knows it is time to accept his fate. "Rise," he tells his disciples. His voice is steady, and he can clearly see the torches and line of men approaching from across the Kidron Valley. Instead of fleeing, Jesus of Nazareth waits. The traitor Judas leads a pack of temple guards into the garden. Each man carries either a club or a sword, and some also wield the torches and lanterns that cut through the darkness. Yet the flames are not bright enough to ensure that the guards can see which of the bearded men before them is Jesus. Judas has anticipated this and walks innocently to the Nazarene. "Greetings, Rabbi," he says coldly, kissing Jesus on the cheek. That is the agreed-upon signal between Judas and the temple guards. "Friend," Jesus replies, "do what you came for." He then turns and looks at the guards. "Who is it you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," comes the reply. "I am he," Jesus answers. The temple guards are not Gentile Roman soldiers, but Jewish employees of the temple courts. Nonetheless, they are physical men, well acquainted with the force needed to make an arrest. Before Jesus' wrist can be tied, however, Peter draws his new sword and cuts off the ear of Malchus, the servant of Caiaphas. Footnote: that scene was witnessed by John, who made it a focal point of his gospel. "Put your sword away," Jesus commands the ever-impulsive Peter. "For those who draw the sword must also die by the sword." Then Jesus submits to being bound and led away. For Judas, all has gone according to plan. At this late hour, few have seen the commotion. So it is that Jesus, his captors, and Judas march to the home of the high priest on the eve of Passover. The disciples lag behind, frightened for their lives. Since it's the middle of the night, a trial is impossible. If religious law is to be obeyed, Jesus must wait until morning to face his accusers. And based upon those same laws, if a death sentence is passed the next morning, The mandatory full day of reprieve before execution would mean that Jesus has at least 1 or 2 days to live. Jesus is not counting on the disciples to come to his rescue. Indeed, if he were, that hope would now be proven futile, for his terrified followers have turned and are now in full flight. The night air is crisp and cool. Most of Jerusalem is asleep as the prisoner is led to the house of the high priest. The route takes them past the room where just a few hours ago Jesus and his disciples celebrated their Last Supper. The Nazarene knows he will die alone. Though he is surrounded by men, Jesus has no allies right now. His disciples have disappeared into the night, and those who arrested him would happily beat him into unconsciousness if he tried to flee. Yet despite his hopeless situation, Jesus of Nazareth keeps his composure. He will be questioned extensively, and what he says will be written for the ages. His interrogators will be the same men whom he verbally humiliated just 2 days ago in the temple courts. He saw the hatred in their eyes then. They pass the houses of the upper city, which are larger and more regal than the dwellings anywhere else in Jerusalem. Jesus is soon led into the palace of the high priest. Only he's not greeted by Joseph Caiaphas, but by the true religious power in Jerusalem. Jesus now stands before the aging and regal leader of a priestly dynasty dating back 1,000 years. The man before him has great wealth and is so skilled a politician that his sons and the husbands of his daughters are continuing the family lineage of priesthood and power. This man's name is Ananus, son of Seti, or as this elderly religious titan is known throughout Jerusalem, Annas. The courtyard is still. Inside, the interrogation of Jesus commences. Moments later, he is surprised by a sudden and hard blow to the face. The end has begun.